Thank you, Brendan. You're listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. The views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au. Now, a reading from Peter. Thank you.
Who gains wisdom? The one who is willing to receive instruction from all sources. Who is the mighty? The one who subdues their temper. Who is rich? The one who is content with their lot. Who is deserving of honour? The one who honours humanity. Despise no one, and deem nothing impossible. Everyone has their time, and everything has its place. Iron breaks stone. Fire melts iron. Water extinguishes fire. The clouds enclose water. The storm dispels clouds. A person can withstand the storm. A person can be conquered by fear. Wine banishes fear. Sleep overcomes wine, and death is the master of sleep. But charity, says Solomon, saves even from death.
So I have some thoughts to share with you today about the Church of Saint Porphyrius. Now, I thought after Anzac Day and all that, you might have tired of me talking about war. So this week I'm just going to talk about one particular church, although it is in Gaza. What lessons can we learn from the microcosm of one particular church, the building and its people? Several of the Unitarian principles come to mind. The inherent worth and dignity of every person. Justice, equity and compassion in human relations. And we seek world community with peace, liberty and justice for all. Perhaps we can bear these principles in mind as I talk about these people. First, some history. Not far from the oldest part of Gaza City, which is an ancient site of human settlement, stands the Church of Saint Porphyrius. And there was indeed a church built on the site 1600 years ago under the guidance of a Christian bishop, Porphyrius. The building we see now dates from the 1100s, the Crusader period, when the church was dedicated to Porphyrius, who by that time was a saint, according to the church. In the days before motorised travel, Gaza was a significant junction for land travel between Africa and Asia. It took many days to cross the Sinai Desert, so travellers from Egypt were grateful to stop in Gaza for rest and refreshments. And equally, when the Greeks, Romans and Turks sought to cross into Egypt overland, Gaza was the place to be fully supplied and stocked up before the last leg of the journey. After Paul, or Saul, and his followers had built up sufficient foundation in Rome, they set about proselytizing their version of the teachings of Yeshua. Yeshua was very much a Jewish rabbi. Paul's great innovation was to take the essence of his teaching beyond the Jewish believers. We know they already had a number of Christians in Gaza in the early 300s because records refer to them being persecuted in the reign of the Emperor Diocletian. At that time, in the area, there would have been a mixture of Jews, Christians, philosophers, followers of the Greeks and Roman gods, and followers of the god Mithras. Even though Emperor Constantine put an end to Christian persecution in 313, Christians continued to be an unpopular minority in Gaza during the 300s. It was against this background that Porphyrius arrived in the year 395. He was Greek, and in a classic example of Christian intolerance, he set about trying to eliminate every other form of worship in Gaza. Now, background, by this time, the Roman Empire had essentially split between East and West. The Byzantine Empire ran out of Constantinople, although sometimes misleadingly referred to as the Eastern Roman Empire, was essentially a Greek empire. And Bishop Porphyrius had sufficient means and influence to go to the court in Constantinople. He was granted troops of soldiers to smash and burn the temples dedicated to the Greek and other gods. The soldiers also raided homes to burn figurines of the Greek gods, etc. Books which were not obviously Christian were deemed books of magic and also burned. They were most likely books of astrology or astronomy, botany and geometry. Beware religious and political leaders who say only they hold the key to the one and only path to salvation, while everyone else is under the influence of Satan. Now, a little linguistics. The early Christian missionaries spoke Greek, of course, but they translated the message into the local Semitic language. Instead of the Greek word for God, theos, from which we get theology, they used Elah, which itself was derived from the senior Canaanite god, the god of that area, Al-Illah. The ill part of Illah is the very same El, which can be found linguistically in the Jewish scriptures, for example, in the book of Genesis, references such as El Shaddai and Elohim. Later, with the Islamic conquests in and after the 7th century, Arabic supplanted Aramaic in the Middle East, and Allah linguistically replaced Allah. Incidentally, the first Bible written in Arabic was written in the 870s, so a couple of hundred years after Islamic dominance began in that area. Muhammad, when he was preaching in Medina 1400 years ago, spoke of Allah as the God of Jews, Christians, and his own followers. And to this day, Arabic-speaking Christians, such as those who attend the St. Porphyrius Church in Gaza, pray to Allah. The Church of St. Porphyrius is a Greek Orthodox church, and the separation of the Roman and Greek empires inevitably led to a formal split in the organization of the churches. The Roman Catholic Church on one side, and the Eastern Orthodox Churches, the primary one being the Greek Orthodox Church, which occurred in 1054. So there are some very minor differences in theology and slightly more differences in the customs and practices of worship. Thank God the Greek Orthodox allowed their priests to marry, for as Paul said, it is better to marry than to burn. That's another story. So here you have on the screen a shot of the inside of the Church of St. Porphyrius, quite a typical layout. Often the ceilings in these churches are blue, representing heaven, and there are many icons of saints and of Jesus. Sometimes you will find depictions of biblical stories as well. Greek Orthodox churches around the world have this screen of icons in front of the altar. And here we see the derivation from Jewish practice, which in the Great Temple in Jerusalem had what was called the Holy of Holies, originally the Ark of the Covenant, in a place right at the deepest part of the church where only the high priest of the Jews could go at a certain time of the year. So there is this element of the laity, the people, the altar, and then the more holy place behind that screen. Like the Roman Catholic clergy, the Greek Orthodox clergy, especially as you go higher up the chain, have some quite spectacular costumes. And it seems to be a cultural imperative for humans to adorn worship leaders with special clothing and jewellery, going right back to tribal societies. The shaman of a tribe would wear particular elements of animal skins and bones to signify their unique oracular role in the tribe. Now, I have none of that, only my thoughts to share. So if they don't make sense or if they don't inspire you, you can just ignore them. I'm not asking for a show of hands, actually. But getting back to the costumes, I must be people coughing politely. I must say, though, when the minister's wife and I travelled to Rome, we walked past an ecclesiastical outfitter's shop. In the window was the most magnificent cloak thing I've ever seen. Might have been a chasuble or something. It was fundamentally white, but with lashings of gold and green and sequins and jewels all over it. It was magnificent. I was so tempted to buy it. But I didn't know I was going to become a Unitarian minister then, so I passed up the opportunity. Let's have some more music from Brendan and Grant. Hold on, and we're going to put the lyrics up because Brendan thought they were quite meaningful and apt. So I continue with a few thoughts about this church. In the 1400s, a mosque was built adjacent to the church, the Kitab al-Wilaya Mosque, the Book of Authority Mosque, referring to the Quran, of course. There are plenty of examples in history of churches, mosques, and synagogues being destroyed and replaced by a new mosque, synagogue, or church on top of the old structure. But presumably the Muslim ruler at the time felt sufficiently secure to build the mosque next to, rather than on top of, this old church. As people fled to a place of sanctuary in the last 6 months, many Christians and Muslims took shelter in the Church of St. Porphyrius together. A priest there, Father Elias, said, "In war, there is no religion." And this is not all that surprising, given that Christians, Muslims, and Jews mostly lived peacefully and productively together for well over 1,000 years in the various Muslim empires. One of the Jewish historians who spoke at Writers' Week in Adelaide recently, Avi Schleim, was born an Iraqi Jew. When he was young, there was little interreligious tension. Many Jews had senior roles in the Iraqi administration. After the 1948 war, when the minority took over Palestine and declared the State of Israel, relations between religious adherents changed in all of the neighbouring countries. Avi's family only decided to leave Iraq after bombs were set off, which clearly had Jewish people as targets. It was only decades later that Avi discovered that Zionist agents acting on behalf of Israel had set the bombs in an effort to promote immigration of Jews to the new state of Israel. The Jewish experience in Christian Europe was sadly very different to the Jewish experience in the Muslim world. And we can completely understand why in the 19th century there developed a movement to find a new home for the Jewish people of Europe. The story today shows how people with different cultural experiences and therefore different narratives can get into violent conflict without a real understanding of the other side. 200 years ago, out near Bathurst in New South Wales, a farmer offered some food to the local Aboriginal tribe as a good neighbour. The Aboriginal people enjoyed eating that food, so they went back and took more when they were hungry. The farmer now saw it as stealing. So a hunting party set out to teach the local people a lesson, killing men, women, and children. Now, from the Aboriginal point of view, they looked over the fence and saw a family and a few workers and hundreds of sheep and lots of food. Obviously, those people had more than they could ever eat, so why not take a sheep or some food when they were hungry? From the farmer's point of view, in the capitalist world of profit and loss, the sheep and potatoes had a money value, which could go toward paying wages, buying clothes, buying a bigger farm, or whatever. So on one side of the fence, it looked like it was sharing an abundance. On the other side of the fence, it was stealing property. A deadly, mutually destructive conflict resulted. What was the situation in Palestine in 1947? From the point of view of European Jews, for their own safety and welfare, it made sense to immigrate to Palestine, encouraged by the Zionist ideology of creating a nation-state specifically for people of that religion. This was supported by scripture, which established that the area had been home to Jewish people thousands of years before. From the Palestinian point of view, immigration of culturally different Europeans with a sense of entitlement was getting out of hand. Palestinians had been living there for countless hundreds of years, and when they saw the Jewish population go from 3% in the year 1900 to nearly one-third of the population in 1947, with increasing tension and occasional violence along the way, many of them thought enough is enough. So whose land was it? Each completely different narrative justified a complete right to the land. Neither side wanted to give that right up to the other. In the end, war resulted. The Europeans were better armed and better coordinated, and they won the opening round convincingly, apart from the Gaza Strip and the eastern part of Jerusalem and the West Bank of the Jordan River. It was at that time that hundreds of thousands of Palestinians fled to neighbouring countries, and many of them settled in the Gaza Strip, temporarily, so they thought. But this explains why many of those sheltering in the Church of St. Porphyrius today would be descendants of those who fled in 1948. On 19th October 2023, bombs struck part of the church compound. The church remained intact, but 18 were killed and dozens were injured. As referred to earlier, it is tradition in that part of the world to bury people in a white shroud for as long as anyone can remember. Traditional for Christians, Muslims, and Jews. And we've heard today that even in Australia these days, Muslims will follow that traditional burial if they possibly can. When you read in the Christian Bible about Jesus being wrapped in a shroud, it is this very practice that continues today. Among the dead were two sisters whose father had been killed in a previous Israeli attack back in 2009. It's an example illustrating that there have been numerous attacks on Gaza in our lifetime, and the current battle is merely the most destructive. But it's not as if it started in October last year. Despite the airstrike and the lack of food and water in this besieged community, religious life continues. Christmas was celebrated, Santa comes to help out, and more recently, Easter. Psychologically, Christianity has a distinct appeal. Apart from a sense of a distant God from whom we can draw inspiration and guidance, for Christians there is that deeply personal sense of attachment to the Jesus figure. For such people, Jesus becomes like a friend they can talk to and listen to. I realise this is not the case for Unitarians. We are left to draw on our inner strength, a deep sense of wisdom and love within us. What can one say about it? It is beyond description. I return to the reading today. You can think about the questions that are posed in relation to your own life, or you can think about them in relation to the conflict between the Zionists and the Palestinians. Do you gain wisdom from all sources? Are you able to subdue your temper? Are you content with your lot? Do you honour humanity? Why is there a need for anxiety when everything has its time and everything has its place? I must say one thing about the final paragraph, and this is quite a typical kind of wisdom formula that you'll find in the Talmud and Jewish wisdom writings. The final line, it's a build-up to this line that charity saves even from death. In other words, charity is the most important thing. Unfortunately, charity doesn't translate very well from the Hebrew. So tzedekah carries much more of a sense of justice and compassion and putting things right with the world. It's much more than putting a few coins in somebody's empty bowl. Tzedekah. Justice, compassion, putting things right in the world. In the week ahead, let us all practice tzedekah. We hope you've enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter. This permission can be obtained by emailing admin@unitarianSA.org.au. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians or by visiting our website at unitarianSA.org.au.